It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the landscape of artificial intelligence and machine learning in medicine and what the future holds for improving health outcomes and patient experiences. Also, what are the limits of computing power and deep learning? Call in with your questions, your comments about AI in medical settings. What is promising to you? What is worrisome? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Regina Barzilai is a School of Engineering Distinguished Professor for AI and Health in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Regina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with that big question first. Just how much of an impact could AI have in medicine?
So I strongly believe, and that's why I kind of changed my research career to work on AI in healthcare, that this is a technology which will truly transform the field. Because today, lots of treatments that are done and diagnostics that are done are kind of very generic, and they're not personalized for each one of us. So since AI can really remember a lot of different patterns, and it should be able to predict for each one of us what is the best possible treatment for us or what we should be looking for when we age. And this capacity to take a lot of personal data and make accurate prediction, I think it's really in the core of potential of AI to transform our healthcare.
In what medical fields or what medical settings could AI be most helpful, make the most advancements?
So the question is where it is now. So right now, the areas where AI is maybe most commonly used in medicine are areas related to the management of the hospitals, you know, how most effectively you utilize the resources, you know, the number of beds in the hospital that are needed to be open, you know, and all these very sort of very rudimentary techniques, but they are important because they can improve the service. But in terms of clinical areas, I would say radiology and pathology and population health are primary area where we already see the impact of AI.
So in particular with pathology and your own experience as you were diagnosed with breast cancer nearly a decade ago, and you've said, talked really openly about how that experience led you into AI and cancer detection. What progress is being made in AI with cancer detection?
So I should say that I personally work on radiology, not on pathology, but there was also a lot of progress on pathology as well. So at the time when I was diagnosed, I already had 3 mammograms. I was going into like 42, 43 years old. I did my mammograms as prescribed at age 40. And my cancer was diagnosed on the 3rd diagram, while, you know, if you're using techniques that we already developed, you can diagnose it on the very first one. And what I discovered at the time is that despite the fact that, you know, MIT is located very close to the top clinical institutions in the country, like Massachusetts General Hospital, there is really no benefits of AI in any parts of, you know, cancer journey, starting from, you know, trying to find patients which look like you based on medical records and see their outcomes to the point of diagnosis and selecting of the treatment. So the area that I decided to focus on was really radiology, because, you know, in this country, after age 40, women are recommended to regularly undergo mammography. And the problem is that, you know, we definitely, radiologists can identify cancer when it is visible, but many times it is not really clear who is in danger of the developing of the disease, who needs to be more careful not to skip their screening, or who needs to be upgraded to MRI. And I am really happy to report that we're working on this problem since 2015-16, so that we actually developed the models that can, looking at the mammograms, predict the development of the disease. And these models are currently clinically tested in multiple institutions.
talking about the impacts of artificial intelligence in medicine with Regina Barzilai, who's a distinguished professor for AI and health at MIT. You can join in with your questions about machine learning in healthcare, what you envision, what you have encountered. 800-642-1234. Regina, can you make a connection for us about the predictive modeling here and the algorithms and how maybe this is able to connect with electronic health records and being able to see patient health issues long before perhaps an oncologist could?
So if I'm to connect, actually want to connect to another experience that we all on daily basis kind of undergo is, for instance, e-commerce like Amazon. So many times Amazon can propose you products that you haven't heard of, and you look at them and you say, wow, I really like to try it. What happens in medicine, typically the diseases are diagnosed much later. And there is a lot of information that is collected about all of us in our medical records. So ideally, what you want to do is not to wait until the disease moves to the very advanced stage. And from the very early points, say, yeah, these patients look that they are going into the direction of developing the disease. And the same thing that, you know, in case of mammograms, like, or now we are doing it for lung cancer, for CT scans, you may not see the tumor. It still didn't form, but you already see that there are processes that move towards tumor formation. And that's what you want to identify before it's really visible as a cancer on the image or in medical records, identify who is likely to get the disease.
How far off are we at letting these algorithms make decisions? I mean, how much human intervention from the specialist is required in looking at the diagnostics?
So I think there are two ways to think about it. One way is the machines doing tasks that humans cannot do. Today, when you're going to your doctor and you do your mammogram, your doctor can only answer the question whether they see mass on your breast or not. They cannot tell you, is it likely you're going to get one in a year? So in this case, machine really have a chance to move forward because they're substituting something humans cannot do. And I think this capacity we already see in many areas. Now, there is a second question is when machine is competing against human, when you are asking machine to do what human can do. And then it's not a technological question. It's a question of regulation and policy when, you know, human experts are going to be comfortable to have machine, you know, working together with them to make decisions.
Yes. I mean, it's about the future of human agency, essentially.
Absolutely.
MIT computer scientist and distinguished professor Regina Barzilai, our guide to the power of artificial intelligence in medicine. What is possible? Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how machine learning technologies will change medicine, making prevention and detection, treatment of diseases and illnesses more personalized, more visionary, if you will, and the barriers that exist to transform the healthcare industry through AI. Share your questions, what you think about with AI in medical visits or progressing through a health scare, what is possible through machine learning, 800-642-1234. Massachusetts Institute of Technology Distinguished Professor Regina Barzilai is here. Let's take a call now. Christine in Milwaukee is with us. Christine, hi.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, I was just curious how this new technology plays out in the medical world of healthcare, because so much in the United States is just dominated by, the insurance companies and really intervening in medical care to get, treated like production. We want to pay the least, just profit driven as opposed to healthcare driven. And I'm curious how this new technology, because, how that plays out in that context.
Christine, thank you. Regina.
Christine, good morning. And it's an excellent question because you are totally correct that any of these technologies to be really part of our healthcare, it needs to go through the insurance and be reimbursable and be part of standard care. If you are looking today at the whole landscape of what technologies are reimbursed by Medicare, all the AI technologies really constitute a tiny, tiny portion of the whole reimbursement package, even though there are more and more technologies which are becoming approved by FDA. So with our technology for early kind of risk assessment and early detection of breast cancer and lung cancer, we're still doing the clinical trials to validate prospectively, meaning when the patients are really treated with this, using the predictions of the model. We still are in this stage. But in this particular case, actually very optimistic about why it was also economically to utilize these technologies. And let me give you, at least my personal thoughts on it. If you're thinking about like how would the women today are screened, the recommendation is to screen every year. But the truth is not all of us need to be screened every year. Some women are in increased risk. Some women are really not. And if machine can accurately tell you, yeah, this patient really needs to come every year or maybe even more, but this patient is okay to come every 2 years, which is a standard in Europe. So in this case, you can actually personalize the screening to a specific risk profile of a patient. And moreover, there are a lot of studies that shows that today, for instance, for breast cancer, patients, there is a huge discrepancy between the real need to get an MRI and who gets an MRI. Majority of people who get breast MRI don't actually need it, and those who need it don't get it. So in this case, if you have a more intelligent system that can help us to correctly, utilize the resources, give them to people who really need them, but let others who don't need them kind of not to spend money and their time, I think that this technology can really save the money both for the insurers and for the patients. So I'm kind of optimistic that we will see more adoption of this technology by insurers coming forward.
And I can see as you paint the picture there, a much more tailored approach that could save time and money in medicine. But, another piece of that, if the cancer isn't showing up on the screen, why would insurance pay for additional testing or other types of lab tests if it's just not there that can be seen? You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. For instance, today we know that MRI is high sensitivity modality. So there are patients who are screened not with mammograms, but with MRI. And as I was saying before, we don't really have a good guidance who needs an MRI. So now you can say, let's say we're spending exactly the same money, whatever insurance pay, 3% of the patients to get MRI. If you are more targeted with who gets it, you are more likely to retrieve cancers for people who are really high risk and leave others intact. And I should say that AI didn't come kind of in total isolation. Previously to that, there are models, most traditional statistical models that look at the number of children, your family history and other things, and aim to predict who is at risk. And actually insurance is required to reimburse, extra screening and extra treatment for women who based on these models are considered to be high risk. The only problem with these models is first, they're extremely inaccurate in comparison to machine learning models on some population, for instance, on Asian populations, on African American, they're really close to random. And the difference here is not like we are suggesting totally new diagnostic modality. We are just saying instead of using very inaccurate old statistical model, let's just use the best of AI to really predict who is at risk.
Because, there are biases built into algorithms. There's documented historical racial bias in medicine. So how do you grapple with that in the code?
So this is actually a very interesting question. When people are talking about bias and AI, They're always thinking about it as some kind of new phenomenon. But if you look at the history of medicine, there are so many, you know, biases that happen because, you know, statistical models that were used before machine learning were just fit on one type of population, but then broadly apply on other populations. Certain studies were done on men, but the conclusions were translated to women, and so on and so forth. So in a sense, now when we're bringing AI into our healthcare, we have an opportunity to totally change it and be much more cognizant as to how well does it perform on different populations. So to just give you an example of our breast cancer model, when we developed it, we used the data from Massachusetts General Hospital, which, you know, does have some African-American and Hispanic population, some Asian population, but of course, predominantly white. We were not satisfied by saying we have a model because we wanted to make sure that it works for other population. And what we've done, we actually went to a lot of hospitals within the United States, for instance, to Carolinas, to Navant and Carolinas. We went to Emory in you know, Atlanta, Georgia. We went to places like Mexico, Taiwan, Sweden, really Israel. And we made sure that the model's performance on this very different population is as good as it was on the MGH population. And I think it's really crucial to do this check to make sure that it does work on, you know, diverse populations.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk with Regina Barzilai about the potential impact of AI in medicine, the impact of machine learning. Regina, a distinguished professor for AI and health at MIT, you can join in with your questions and experiences in healthcare and what impact powerful computing could have. 800-642-1234. Regina, I want to turn to trust because there was the recent Pew Research Center survey found 6 in 10 American adults say they would feel uncomfortable if their own healthcare provider relied on AI to diagnose diseases and to recommend treatments. How can providers build trust in their use of AI?
I think that the question is really to make providers themselves be comfortable with AI. And this is a big problem because majority of clinicians today, which are trained in, you know, standard medical school, their understanding of how AI technologies works is very limited because it's not what they studied at school. And also this is still an emerging technology. So let's say even the patient doesn't understand how certain blood tests work or sequencing, genome sequencing works. You know, it's been for a while there, it becomes part of standard of care. There is a lot of literature that shows that it works and it builds trust both for providers and for the patients. In AI, we're still in a very early stages when providers are not well informed, when there is no clear, you know, evidence for many claims about AI, and they think it creates huge unease in patients. So this is actually something that we learn when we're doing clinical trials with our breast cancer tools. Part of it is really doing patient education and explaining to them what these models can and cannot do.
As a patient, I would wonder under what circumstances would my physician be willing to outsource her decisions or, you know, her recommendations to digital systems in my visit?
I think that the way I'm thinking about it, that the final decision should always be taken by the provider in consultation with the patient. But this is just an extra piece of information that can be used to guide your clinical decision-making rather than somebody else, you know, takes control and you just get a number and your treatment is done. But I can tell you as a patient, and I'm talking from personal experience, that many times decisions are made for us and we don't really even understand the rationale behind them and we are complacent with it. And talking about breast cancer, like in this country, there is a federal law that requires any provider who does mammogram to give you a letter that reports your density and says that if you have high density, you're in increased risk of breast cancer. and your cancer may be missed on the mammogram. And there are, I think, 8 states where you can actually, based on it, get a supplemental screening. But the truth is that almost half of the women actually have dense breasts. So we are now getting a letter. Half of the women are getting a letter, and we are complacent with it. Does it really make sense to anybody? And I remember when I got this letter at age 40, on one hand, they gave me the letter because it is mandated. But on the other hand, they told me, don't worry about it. I went to MIT at the time. Half of MIT gets this letter.
I want to pause. I want to just pause right there with Massachusetts Institute of Technology computer scientist Regina Barzilai, AI faculty lead for the Jameel Clinic. You can call in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Artificial intelligence is changing healthcare. We're in conversation with a renowned computer scientist who's behind this revolution in medicine. And on top of it, call in with your questions, your thoughts about using AI in medicine, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Regina Barzilai is a School of Engineering Distinguished Professor for AI and Health, part of the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. Regina, you were talking about the breast density notification law, federal laws, how common these letters are, and helping to understand the connection that you see to AI here. Can you tell us a bit more what you are seeing there?
So this is actually one instance of the general question of how, you know, the regulatory state of regulatory affairs really impacts the development of the technology. So the breast density law, which was enacted, I think, 3 years ago, requires every provider to tell to the woman what is her density status and warn her that she is in increased risk of cancer if her breast is dense. The question is, you know, how accurate is this particular biomarker? And the truth is it's extremely, extremely loose because it cannot be that half of the American population is in high risk of breast cancer. But at the same time, AI can, in much more precise way, to identify those women who are at risk. So here we can clearly see the case that not only you're creating a false alarm because the biomarker is weak, but also in many states, it is mandatory to pay for supplementary screening, again, using extremely weak information. So moving from these imprecise biomarkers to something extremely precise, that's what AI is good at. And that's why when you asked me earlier the question, you know, how people feel about it, I was thinking that as a patient, when I was told that I had high density breast, I didn't think much about it because in my family, nobody had breast cancer. And the clinician herself told me that it's 50%, so I shouldn't worry about it. And this is a case where we are trusting the recommendation where we should not have been trusting it. But on the other hand, there is really a place to have much more accurate prediction tool. And I hope as we see more and more penetration of the tool, it will increase the trust of the public of relying on them as an extra source of information.
What about the role of transparency and really urging AI systems in medicine to be more transparent and, you know, helping us understand perhaps their underlying code for others to analyze? What do you see happening on that front?
Can I ask your question?
Sure.
Do you have a microwave at home?
Yes.
Do you use your microwave?
Indeed.
Do you understand how microwave works?
Nope.
Exactly. And I can continue with your car and with your coffee maker and many other things. So why do we rely on these devices in our daily life? Because we know that they work, but sometimes when they don't work, there will be, you know, a red light flashing. They say you shouldn't be using me, correct? We don't assume that what makes the device good is because it is transparent, that we can understand, you know, all the logic of it. And when your car kind of breaks down, you know that you need to bring it to the repair shop.
You hand the keys over.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that this whole discussion about transparency of AI is really, really misleading. Because where we need primarily AI in healthcare is where humans cannot predict. Like humans cannot tell you who is going to get breast cancer. Humans cannot tell you who is going to get Alzheimer's, you know, many years in advance. Now there are AI systems who can make these predictions. Even if you are undergoing treatment, the doctor cannot tell you which one of the side effects you are guaranteed to have because, you know, each one of us is different. AI system can make many of these predictions. But the problem is that the type of patterns and regularities that they use are kind of beyond sometimes our capacity to see pattern. To make a very simple analogy, you know, the dogs or animals in general, but dogs in particular, have very rich olfactory receptors. So they can smell a lot of smells that we cannot smell. So none of us will be upset that we cannot really recognize our neighbors based on smell. While we are hoping that we as humans would be able in some ways understand and validate the reasoning of machines that are so much more sophisticated in terms of capturing patterns. So to me, and this is my personal opinion, for you know, this idea of making transparent system and conditioning the adoption of the systems on their transparency and ability to explain themselves is not the right direction. I think the right thought is to provide to the machine this ability to say, I don't know.
So don't roll your eyes here, though, about the black box effect, because I'm going to ask you anyway. You know, I mean, so often we're here about, you know, researchers typically know the inputs and the outputs, but it's hard to see what's going on inside. So the black box effect. And I know that you see this problem as a myth. What could allay our fears about the so-called black box problem?
I think that it's actually not totally true to say that we don't know. Machine, for instance, when it reads an image and predicts something human cannot predict, it can sort of show you at which part of the image it looks. But the question is, even if it shows to you what you as a human can do with it, humans cannot really say, does it mean that this part of the image with some whites in it really tells you that the patient is going to develop the disease? So the point is, it's not like machine cannot tell you. Machine can. Mm. The problem is that we cannot really validate it because we don't understand. And if we are requesting to translate machine explanation to the language that we understand, you're kind of throwing the baby with the water. So to me, again, the key capacity that we need to ensure that AI can do is just to tell us we don't know when we don't know. And in this way, you just don't use a machine. So instead of looking for kind of opening a black box and trying to find an explanation.
I still need that microwave. I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment.
Well, maybe you can have the next program here dedicated to microwaves.
Yes.
And how they work, which is a fascinating question. But the question that you ask, I mean, I think it's a very natural question to ask because we always try to understand and validate. Do you know what really kind of surprises me that it's not only people who are kind of not in the field asking this question, but if you're looking at FDA regulation, this whole idea that builds on human understanding is really, really puzzling and surprising to me.
Regina Barzilai, MIT Distinguished Professor for AI and Health. You can join in on AI and Medicine, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Bob in Madison now. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm thinking about the diagnosis aspect of medicine, and it comes to me that there's two parts, probability and intuition. And my guess is that if a person comes to a doctor with a headache, it's probably not cancer, but it might be. And the question for a doctor would be, how do I narrow down the thousands and thousands of factors that will tip me to make my intuition describe it as something that should go to an MRI? And my guess is that that the AI is very, very good at narrowing down the probability and giving that thousands of factors a narrower focus for the doctor. But the intuition part is really the key, and that's the part which is art, and a good doctor is really an artist. And I'm wondering, as a person who is studying the AI, you must be fascinated with that art aspect, the intuitional aspect, and trying to get closer and closer to AI becoming part of I'm kind of at the end of what I can describe.
Bob, and appreciate you so much for bringing that. Regina, go ahead.
So first of all, it's really a great idea, a great thought, that part of it is really doctor's intuition and hunch. Now, it is not really clear, and I would defer to my colleagues in cognitive science, you know, what creates human intuition, but part of it is really having a lot of experience, and some doctors can abstract from this experience much better than others. You know, in case of AI, it's not true for any area of medicine, but for the areas where you have a lot of data, you can feed into AI data from millions of patients that no doctor in their biological life can see. So what we now see as kind of spark of intuition from the doctor, machine, if provided with enough data, can learn. Now, the truth is that there are many areas of medicine that today we just don't have enough data. And unfortunately, in these areas, we will still rely on the spark of intuition of a good doctor. But at the same time, there are already lots and lots of areas where machine can not have an intuition, but can just learn this pattern given a very diverse and large training set. So the way I'm thinking about it, the good doctor and the good machine have different strengths, and we just need to put them together to improve the outcomes.
Integrate them, really an integrative approach. I'm wondering, Regina, if you could help us step back to understand where we are in this progression. Like, are we co-evolving with powerful computer systems? How long will this type of, you know, murkiness, if you will, last? I mean, where are we in the evolution of AI? What point are we at right now?
So I think that it's actually very unsettling to me how little AI, real AI, you see in medical doctors. And each one of us, let me ask you, when you went to your doctor, did you see any AI in your clinic when you went to your regular visit?
I don't think so, but I don't really know now. Now I'm starting to question. Certainly the systems that I would imagine got me into the room in the first place, which you had mentioned earlier.
For the majority of the population, and even again, I'm going to the hospitals here, to Massachusetts General Hospital and others, there is really no AI that the patient can see, and very little that they cannot see. And a big part of it has to do not with the state of the technology. Lots of this technology are really ready for deployment. A big part of it is regulatory affairs, as we already discussed, FDA issues, and also finding a way to truly validate them so that the clinical regulation and standards of care will change. And so far, I think this part of translation going really, really slow. And this is my personal projection, but I believe in other parts of the world we will see much faster, and we already see much faster adoption of AI than here.
Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Distinguished Professor Regina Barzilai, AI faculty lead for the Jamil Clinic, that's an MIT Center for Machine Learning and Health. As we look at the technology, the diagnostics, the new machine learning components in medicine, and where it's headed, still time to explore your questions of AI in medicine and what the potentials are. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine questions about AI and machine learning research in medicine. Still time to bring your question to the discussion. Call 800-642-1234. Massachusetts Institute of Technology Distinguished Professor for AI and Health, Regina Barzilai, is here. Regina, a listener sent an email at WPR.org, and they say that they were diagnosed with a serious disease 30 years ago, and they really have concerns about a system that will, quote, document potential risk. And until the Affordable Care Act, they could not get health insurance and still cannot get long-term care insurance, and they really continually worry about their employer finding out and letting them go, that it'll impact their job. So can you speak to those concerns about privacy?
I think this is really an important and serious concern. How do you utilize technology to actually benefit patients rather than create additional barriers for getting the care they need? And, you know, the similar question comes with the genetic testing and others. So what we've seen, I'm just making an analogy to the genetic testing. If you're thinking about patients who have BRCA, who are in the increased risk of breast cancer and other cancers, the fact that on one hand they were screened, that you know what is a pathway to help them to decrease the chance of the disease, save life of many, many patients. But on the other hand, if this information is used inappropriately, these patients would be declined appropriate care. So in summary, I think that here the role of legislation, the right legislation, is really key to really prevent misuse of this information for patient care and only utilize these technologies for patient benefit. And I think it's a big open question how to do it.
We really have to watch the regulatory policies going forward here as this powerful form of AI really starts to take hold. I want to turn now to get your two cents here on ChatGPT, because, you know, the birth of ChatGPT late last year, it just really set off quite a bit of flurry of how, you know, an AI chatbot is changing how people work. What could it be doing for medicine?
So I just want to know that before I moved to work on AI in medicine, I actually work on natural language processing. And I started working in this field in 1997, you know. And when I took the first class, we didn't have one system that could do anything productive. So it sounded in 97 a technology that, you know, you can sort of, you know, fly on Mars and build yourself a house. It was so, so far. And within really a decade, we already have seen machine translation or as part of, you know, Google browser and many other technologies flourishing. So all of a sudden, we see this humongous gap, you know, in technological performance that now ChatGPT became one of the most popular tools ever. So it teaches us two lessons. One is that, you know, if the development in technology continues, even though it's, you know, it starts a bit slow, eventually we see really big fruits. And I hope that right now where we are in medicine and AI, we're kind of in the very early stages still, but at some point we're going to have other equivalents of ChatGPT in diagnostics and care. But if we're talking specifically about ChatGPT in the healthcare community, I think there are a lot of uses primarily related to documentation. Like today, when you enter to your doctor's office, most of the time the doctor is busy just taking notes rather than conversing with you because of the compliance regulation and everything should be recorded. So incorporating this type of tools that can help us document, that can help us find information in language, can really change the way the information is stored in process, because most of it is still done in natural language, in English.
Mm. I wonder, though, can chatbots become culturally acceptable in the doctor's office? Because, you know, so many of these clinics are really marketing themselves on that personal touch and the physician knowing you. And so if we have, you know, I don't know, a robotic device like just taking down the notes of our history, I don't know if we lose touch on some of that personal aspect of medicine.
But I am thinking that the personal touch is not the fact that they record what you are saying. The personal touch is if actually they have a chance to look at you, you know, to hear, to pay attention to what you are saying, rather than to pay attention to the computer and what they're writing. So if they can really free the time of this very mechanical part of the work that really doesn't benefit us very much and really converse with us and pay attention to us as human to human, I think it actually can totally change our experience and connect us better with our providers.
I wonder how you felt about ChatGPT being able to pass the U.S. medical licensing exam.
I always thought that good memory is one important part of being a doctor. So I think this is very much not surprising, but it comes to the idea that machines do have an amazing capacity to put the amount of information to the in their possession that we as humans would never remember. And it's a very positive thing that if we think about it carefully, technologically, and also in terms of legislation, we can utilize it to the patient benefit.
In our last moments together, I want to ask you something a bit more personal in how you are able to juggle this really exciting research and giving your all to it, but also the classroom teaching and carrying on to teach the next generation of computer scientists and engineers.
I think that all of them, they actually connect together. And one of the very amazing opportunities that I have at MIT is to talk to these very young people who decided to explore science. And my personal hope that in order to enable to make, you know, clinical AI as flourishing as ChatGPT, we need to have a lot of minds entering this field and be ready to do revolution and transformation. So whenever I'm doing my research or whenever I'm teaching or advising, I'm always trying to preach that this is an area that we all care about because all of us go to the doctor. So we really need to put all our energy to transform it.
How do we make sure we transform it across the world, that we don't leave developing nations behind in this technology revolution?
We actually, this is a very important question. It also, as we've seen during the last pandemic, how interconnected is the world? So we cannot just isolate ourselves and make ourselves healthy on the, you know, and forget about others because of the nature of many of these diseases. So actually at MIT, we, with the funding from Wellcome Trust, which is a big charity from the UK, created a network of hospitals around the world, from Africa, from Latin America, India, and other parts of the world, where we are exploring how these AI tools can be adapted in these very different healthcare systems, what we learn from it, and what are the new technologies that we need to develop for them. You know, to improve the quality of care.
Regina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Regina Barzilai, MIT Distinguished Professor for AI and Health in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.